The Mark Steiner Show is sponsored in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. What if you're struggling with your mortgage? The state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's National Foreclosure Settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome, everybody. We're going to continue our conversation about the war in Iraq 10 years later. One of those folks who was on this program before the war started, as we debated this war up to the beginning over that long period of time, was Stephen Zunis. And Stephen Zunis is professor of politics and international studies and chair of the Middle Eastern Studies program at the University of San Francisco. He's senior analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus, and author of Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict, Irresolution, and Tinderbox U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism, and many articles, recently pieces in newspapers on this 10th anniversary, which nobody seems to want to talk about very much. And Stephen Zunis, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Great to be on again.
Stephen, let me just begin with a question we've been wrestling with on this program leading up to the 10th anniversary and on the 10th anniversary of the war, which is why the press, The Washington Post, The New York Times, any number of newspaper chains around the country that were so adamant about why this war needed to be fought, about weapons of mass destruction leading up to this war, saying that they existed, taking the administration's stance hook, line, and sinker without questioning it. Why are all of them so silent now about the war, reflecting on what happened, reflecting on what the press did? I mean, the silence is almost deafening.
It is quite remarkable, and I think the answer is pretty obvious, that they're embarrassed about their coverage. Not just the repeating the lies about Iraq having chemical and biological weapons programs and actual chemical and biological weapons and a nuclear program and sophisticated delivery systems and ties to al-Qaeda. Absolutely none of these things were true. It's not only the fact that they seem to take these bizarre claims at face value, despite many strategic analysts, myself included, challenging these claims. But also I think the failure to predict the consequences of the war, the long drawn out bloody counterinsurgency campaign, the increase in sectarianism and Islamic extremism, the enormous financial and human costs. People like me were saying this beforehand, they refuse to take these concerns seriously. So obviously they're embarrassed to recap the mistakes. We have had a few articles out about the whole WMD controversy, getting all that wrong, but it. What strikes me about that is that the war would have been illegal even if Iraq did had somehow been able to recreate such an arsenal, and still it would have been a long drawn out bloody a conflict. And so I think on both counts the press coverage continues to be lacking. Oh, I should also mention the other gripe I have is that what little coverage there has been has seemed to indicate that there was some kind of broad consensus about this, that everybody thought they had weapons of mass destruction. But in fact, if you look at academic journals ranging from the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, the Arms Control Today, if you look at the testimony of former weapons inspectors, Scott Ritter and others, if you look at arms control analysts, everything and coverage, everything from the Institute for Policy Studies to the Institute for Global Security Studies to the Koch Center at Notre Dame, the Oxford Research Group, these and others, similarly not only raised questions about the alleged Iraqi threat, but also warned of the consequences of the invasion and occupation. So there were plenty of voices out there, and including some voices on Capitol Hill, albeit a minority. But you know, these voices seem to have been forgotten as well.
Well, I'm going to reflect that a bit more before we jump into your really interesting essays about what the war has cost us and the Middle East and Iraq and Arab and Muslim nations. But going back to that moment, what does it say about to you about power and the press in America? I mean, because I remember leading up to the war, we had dozens of discussions on the air. Mm-hmm. And there were, as you said, there were ample studies and ideas saying there may not be WMDs. There probably are not WMDs. Scott Ritter was on this program talking about that. There were journalists who were writing and analysts writing from all over the world saying if the United States invades Iraq, then it's going to disrupt the entire country and be stuck there for years. It's going to create all kinds of sectarian warfare, and it could be a disaster for the entire Middle East. I mean, these were things that were said. But it's almost as if people were crying in the wilderness and not being heard. What is it about power and the power of press in this government as well that none of that was heard or paid attention to?
I think part of it is that the press being increasingly profit oriented. That the previous divisions you had between the news and the business end of the particular enterprise, like a TV network or whatever, that has largely disappeared. And there's been cutbacks in staffing. You no longer have as many investigative reporters as you used to. So the best way you get the news is through official sources. And if you are critical of the administration, your people are not going to be called on in the press conferences, but some of your rivals will. And similarly, in terms of getting the news leak, your rivals are going to get the scoops, not you. And so they have to learn to be nice to the people in power, to not question them, because then they can get the handouts, they can get the goodies, maybe they can get a leg up on their competitors. And so that is part of the attitude. It's also, I think, the fact that the right wing, far more than the left, has been able to push this to apply pressure to the media. Despite the media being quite conservative and status quo oriented, this myth of the liberal media seems to so predominate the discourse that the media feels they have to cater to the right more than they do the left. But I think also, though, there's this tendency, I think, especially in the time after 9/11, that there was some public pressure from people who did not want to hear critical negative things about government. And this is combined with, I think, the timidity of the Democrats to speak out against this, because much of the media, if it's a controversy, if one party says one thing and one party says the other. But while the majority of Democrats nationally and the majority of Democrats in Congress oppose going to war, the leadership, Dick Gephardt in the House of Representatives, and Tom Daschle and Harry Reid in the Senate, along with Joe Biden, John Kerry, and other influential senators, were going along giving the administration's line. And so as a result, the media said, well, if the Democrats aren't speaking out and questioning these things, why should the press?
So, I mean, and I think that is the case, and it's even the case now in many ways, and I think that it's probably getting worse instead of better in terms of that openness and being heard, whether the president is George Bush or Barack Obama. I think people are pretty and where the press has gone, I think that it's become a pretty stunning over the last 10, 12 years how progressive left liberal people on the left in general and other scientists and thinkers are just not heard. So I wonder what you think of in terms of what you've written about the consequence of this war, because there are many people who are writing that, look, well, the war, at least we brought democracy to Iraq. Mm-hmm. We got rid of an evil dictator. That's better now than it was. And that is part of the popular wisdom, is it pushed by numbers of people in the press and in columns now.
And that's particularly silly. A number of reasons. First of all, as we've seen in Tunisia and Egypt and Yemen, there are other ways of getting rid of nasty dictators than foreign intervention. Indeed, the vast majority of the 70 or more authoritarian regimes that have been overthrown or forced to step down or forced to reform some form of democratic structure has done through democratic civil society organizations engaged in strategic nonviolent action. We've seen this from Chile to Serbia, from Poland to the Philippines, and more recently in a number of Arab countries. But even putting that aside, the fact is that Iraq is nothing close to a functional democracy. The government is engaged in widespread and systematic human rights violations, including torture and extrajudicial killings. When pro-democracy protests have sprung up, most recently a few months ago, but back in the spring of 2011 as well, they were brutally suppressed, and offices of their were shut down. Their supporters were kidnapped and jailed, and in some cases executed. During the testimony during Bradley on his on charges of leaking the documents to WikiLeaks, he said that the issue that put him over the edge was the was how his unit was helping government death squads murder not just suspected hardline opponents, but those who were journalists who were uncovering corruption and misdeeds by the government. And this is the kind of thing that that the United States has been supporting in Iraq. It's a semi-authoritarian regime, sectarian in nature, and the Transparency International rates it among the three or four most corrupt governments on earth. This is hardly any kind of model for democracy.
And what about what it's done to us, done to this nation?
Yeah, well, the financial costs are huge. I mean, the outright cost of just the war itself has been close to $1 trillion. If you count the ancillary costs, it has been probably twice that. And then when you count all the interest on the national debt, we're going to have to be paying for decades since all this money was borrowed. As one of the first wars where there was not an tax increase to pay for it. Combined with the fact that we have to take care of all these wounded veterans and PTSD and the physical injuries and everything else for many, many years, some estimates are as high as $4 to $6 trillion. It'll be the most expensive war in U.S. history, something that we're going to be paying for many, many years. It's the reason that one of the major reasons that the deficit is as big as it is, and thus leading to the sequester and other cutbacks in programs here at home. This is the this is a financial cost that we're suffering. Not to mention the fact that the United States is increasingly isolated in the international community because of this. You have extremists around the world who are saying, "Hey, if the United States is powerful as it is, and as many resources, economic and military and diplomatic, the United States has at its disposal, if the United States cannot play by basic rules." Such as if you cannot engage in this kind of aggressive war, we can violate the UN Charter and other basic things like that. Well, if the United States can get away with this kind of law breaking, why should anybody else play by the rules? It's really contributed to greater international anarchy, which I think is really going to hurt U.S. strategic interests in the long run.
So when you look, as someone who is an expert in the Middle East, who teaches and studies and writes on what's happening in the Middle East, what are these things? What should we be saying to us now? What should we be thinking about and talking about in terms of what the world faces now? You look at the increasing upheaval in the streets of Egypt between people on the left and more secular groups in Egypt and democratic groups versus the Muslim Brotherhood. You see what's going on in Tunisia, Syria, obviously, and also what's going on in among Palestinians and Israelis. I wonder what lessons you think we need to wrestle with that might have come out of this 10-year experience about what we're facing now, what the world's facing now.
Well, I think basically that ordinary people are recognized as the drivers of change. And that, there's something really wrong with the fact the United States has been the world's number one supporter of dictatorships and occupation armies in the Middle East and North Africa for so many years. We've supported these regimes which have, in divide and rule strategies, encouraged sectarianism. They have suppressed democratic civil society organizations, that some of the best and brightest people have been jailed and murdered or forced into exile. And then when these countries try to become more democratic and get kind of messy, you have pundits saying, these Arabs, these Muslims, they're not capable of democracy or whatever, when the United States has done so much to suppress, to support the suppression of civil society, to support the suppression of democratic institutions. And then we wonder why the transitions are somewhat problematic. But the fact is that the struggle for freedom in the Arab world, like the rest of the world, has been making some remarkable gains. I think that people have recognized the power of strategic nonviolent action, and they are organizing. And I mean, stuff that's happening in Egypt is very disappointing on a whole number of levels. But at least people are resisting far more than they were able to do so under the Mubarak regime, and I think the short to medium term is going to be pretty messy there. The younger generation is including observant Muslims among the younger generation, by and large, support political pluralism, support the democracy, and the aging generation of the Brotherhood, just like the aging generation of Mubarak and the military, their time has passed. I think the future is definitely one that's going to be a more democratic one. The question is, which side is the United States going to be on? Are we going to continue to be supporters of the status quo, of the militaries, of the occupation, Israeli and Moroccan occupation forces, of the Gulf monarchies, or are we going to be on the side of people in the future? So, which is one of greater freedom and social justice.
So how do you see? How do you define, from your perspective, what that means to be on the side of freedom and justice for the people who are struggling in the world, whether it's Pakistan or Iran or Syria or Egypt or Tunisia or any place, or Israel for that matter, or Palestine? What would be the recommended policy for America? How do you pursue that policy?
Well, first and foremost, is to stop supporting the dictatorships and stop supporting the occupation armies. That, there's not a whole lot the United States can and should do in terms of directly supporting pro-democracy struggles. Many of these groups would fear that a direct U.S. aid would hurt their credibility among their people, given the longstanding U.S. support for authoritarianism. There's concern that the U.S. try to push its economic agenda. I mean, often the National Endowment for Democracy and other groups that do profess support for democracy groups have a distinct bias towards those that support market economy and closer relations to the West and some of the more popular, broadly based groups. So I have some mixed feelings about any kind of direct support for pro-democracy groups. But as with the Hippocratic Oath of physicians, the first rule is to do no harm. And that means conditioning military and economic aid to governments of the region with their compliance of international standards of human rights and particularly international humanitarian law. And so I think if this and to encourage other governments, which supply such weapons and other security assistance to regimes, to do the same. I mean, the United States, quite reasonably, has been critical of the Russians and Chinese for vetoing some very modest UN Security Council resolutions regarding Syria. but we don't have much standing when we have vetoed far more UN Security Council resolutions, or threatened to veto UN Security Council resolutions regarding violations of international humanitarian law by our own allies, such as Israel and Morocco and others. Similarly, you know, the criticism about the Russians providing arms to Syria, again, that criticism is quite reasonable, but it rings hollow when the U.S. has armed so many governments in that part of the world that have been responsible for the death, also have been responsible for the death of tens of thousands of civilians.
So, I'm as we watch the events unfold, some would argue, even from my liberal left position, that to do nothing, just to say shouldn't support dictators, but not supporting freedom fighters in, let's say, in Syria, and that's difficult to define given the divide there between secular and Salafists and others in Syria, and the same thing in Egypt. I mean, should a policy be just to stand back? I mean, what should policy be?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, obviously the impulse is you want to do something, given the role the United States played in that part of the world, unfortunately, you know, too overt intervention can sometimes, you know, play into the hands of the regime. And like those of Syria, which have played the nationalist card, and you know, U.S. Given that U.S. has actively supported Israeli occupation of much of southwestern Syria, how we block the Israelis from even negotiating with the Syrians when Assad sued for peace, you know, several years ago, when we have bombed periodically Syrian positions in Lebanon and elsewhere, when we have demanded and imposed sanctions on Syria to change certain policies that we have defended when other governments have done so. I mean, all this has really raised questions about whether the U.S. interest in Syria really is for promoting democracy or just getting rid of a regime that we don't like. And so getting involved too heavily, again, could play into the regime's hands. Now, at the same time, there really is something of humanitarian imperative of the international community responding in some way. You know, the United States has had some small-scale programs that have, during the earlier phase of the struggle, and it was largely nonviolent, in terms of supporting these civil society groups, you know, providing them some money, communication, equipment, that kind of thing. There's a small office in Istanbul that has done, workshops and other training regarding issues of civil resistance and that sort of thing. I mean, I think that kind of work, you know, might be appropriate. But given that the armed struggle has seemed to have made things worse instead of better, rather than protecting the Syrian civilians, the death toll of civilians has increased dramatically since the shift to armed struggle. Given that the armed struggle has brought out some rather extremist elements to the fore, and that in many ways it is challenging the regime where it is strongest, that is military force, and just kind of sending more arms to a rather fractured and disorganized armed rebellion, which has primary result of the armed rebellion has been more and more people killed. They haven't liberated much more territory than they did when you had these nonviolent groups taking over neighborhoods and towns and the like. And I really don't see how providing military aid or otherwise supporting the armed rebellion is really going to make things better and instead of worse.
Stephen Zunis, it's always a pleasure to talk to you and what the ideas you bring forth to the table. And thank you so much for joining us here on the Mark Steiner Show today to kind of reflect on 10 years after Iraq and how it affects America and the entire Middle East.
My pleasure.
We're going to take a really brief break and come right back. And when we do, we're going to talk about rites of passage. There's a national conference coming to Baltimore this July called the National Rites of Passage Institute Youth Conference. that's going to wrestle with and teach us all about the rites of passage and the processes that can change our lives, whether it's issues of violence, incarceration, academic performance of our kids, or just creating community. First, a break, and come right back.
This is Councilman Nick Mosby of the 7th District. Mark, I would like to congratulate you on 50 years of hard work and dedication.
Join the Center for Emerging Media Board as they honor Mark Steiner for his 20 years on the air and 50 years working for justice. April 6th at ABAM. More information at steinershow.org/2050. Champion sponsors, the Osprey Foundation and Clean Cuts, Cerebral Lounge, Media Partners, the Baltimore Business Journal, and WEAA-FM.